Mitzvah Reish Samech Beis 262, Shelo Laleches Bechukos Hagoyim, not to walk in the ways, the statutes of the non-Jews. Shelo Laleches Bechukos HaEmori, not to go in Amorite statutes. Again, he was more general in the title than he is now, but we'll see in a second that it's not Lav Dafka over here. V'chein Bechukos Hagoyim, the same in any other nation. Shneamar Lo Selchu Bechukos Hagoyim Asher Ani Meshalech Mipneichem. Don't go, will go in the ways of the Gentiles that I send forth from before you, meaning the ones who live in Eretz Yisrael now. But it's not limited. Any non-Jews. It doesn't mean specifically the non-Jews who are living in Eretz Yisrael at the time. That was just Diber Behoveh, so to speak. That they'll get, the Torah talks in a manner that's directly relevant at the time, that those are the most influential Gentile nations who are going to have a possible impact on the Jewish people, but really it applies to all Gentiles as well. And this code, this same idea is found at the end of Parashat Zacharimos, Sehem Lo Selechu, which is not, there he didn't treat it as an independent mitzvah, but it's the same idea expressed in the end of Parashat Zacharimos. Ki ha'inyan mivnei shehem, sarim me'achari Hashem ve'ovdin avodah zara. So if you copy their things, even if they're not necessarily directly related to avodah zara, the impact is going to get into your head, and you're going to start worshiping avodah zara or leaning in that direction. V'inyan ha'mitzvah hu shelo nishanahe kohem b'malbusheinu v'inyonenu. We shouldn't do, to use the original Yiddish, goyish zachem. We shouldn't do non-Jewish things such as dress, such as other types of ways of action. Kemo she'amru b'sifra, uvechukoseyam lo selechu, she'lo selchu b'nimusosham. Again, this sifra is in Parshas Achrimos, but he applies over here where he's counting the mitzvah. So we shouldn't go with their ways, their conventions, b'dvarim hachakukim lahem, the things that they are known to do, kegon titros, theaters, b'kirkisos, circuses, Vistarios, which is brought in other versions as Itztadios, which means stadiums. So we have direct English words that parallel these three things. V'chol elu hem minei schok she'osem b'kibbutzen k'shem iskabtzen laso shig'onos uznus v'avodas elilim. So these places are places where they gather to do crazy things and promiscuous things and idolatrous things. So all in think just in terms of ancient Rome, so you have the gladiators meeting in the Colosseum, which was something that completely went against anything Jewish, and I probably was in honor of some sort of deity. So therefore, that's considered chukos hagoyim. There, Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says, "Well, what about nowadays circuses and theaters and all these things? Is this chukos hagoyim to go to the theater and to go to the circus?" So he says, might not be mutter, because it might be bittul Torah and other things, but he thinks that technically this is not chukos hagoyim nowadays, because this has nothing to do with avodah zarah at all. It's just silly completely, which, I mean, is not the impression you necessarily get from the classical sources, that even things that are just a Gentile thing, even if it doesn't directly have to do with avodah zarah, you're still not allowed to do it. But nevertheless, Moshe Feinstein says that if nowadays, if you go to the theater, so luckily you're not in violation of this mitzvah. I mean,
and Yankee Stadium is not included here. In this.
Obviously, that was the minhag. It was in the Bronx. All good Jews used to go to Yankee Stadium to go to sporting events. So, yeah, so it's a good question, but presumably these things that Sefer Chinuch and the sources in Chazal are talking about are more severely problematic than just sporting events, which are just, you know, harmless entertainment relatively. These are not, these things that are not harmless, these things that says Shigonus Uznus Vavudas Elilim, these don't sound so harmless. You know what I mean? These are, yeah?
The stuff that's out there today, I mean, it's
right. If you go to a play that contains nus in it, so then yes, that would be subject to potentially, in addition to the problems of causing yourself to have inappropriate thoughts and to just to stoke the flames of the Yetzirah. So yeah.
But that same would apply to a book or anything else, or you know, or a video, or you see by yourself.
Well, you could argue that, you know, a book is less b'chukosei amlo seleichu, because you're going to an event that's a goyish event.
Yeah. Something which contains nus. You know,
right. That would apply. Right, that's a separate prohibition in and of itself. But it could, if you go to an event that contains one of these things. Right.
Right.
If you go to a public event that contains one of these things, you could imagine that the prohibition of the b'chukosei amlo seleichu applies here as well as the prohibition of stoking the flames of the Yetzirah. Mm-hmm. V'amru sham b'chukos hagoy, Reb Meir Omer, so the Tanaim disagree as to what exactly the parameters are. Maybe they don't disagree, they just add separate things. Reb Meir Omer, Elu Darkei HaMori Shemanu Chachamim. Remember in the Mishnah a little bit, and mostly in the Tosefta and Masechet Shabbos, it discusses all different things which are Darkei HaMori, which are superstitious practices that Jews are not allowed to engage in. So Reb Meir says that this V'chukoseim Lo Seleichu is an explicit reference in the Torah to these things that the sages counted as Darkei HaMori, such as wearing a red string around your wrist, or all these different things. If you shecht a if a hen called like a rooster, and you shecht it immediately, because it's all these superstitious things. These are all chukas agoyim. Rabbi Yehuda, yeah, go into it in more detail here. Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseir Omer shelot tegadel tzitzis harosh kohen velot tesaper kumi. You shouldn't grow out your hair, shouldn't grow long hair, in a manner that's copying the ways of the non-Jews. Kolomar shelot galeach min atzdadin v'yaniach sear beemtza v'zeo anikra bloris. So there was a specifically non-Jewish style of haircutting, which is that you cut the sides and you left the top.
Mohawk, does,
right, like a mohawk, exactly. So it could be shorter on top than we would consider a mohawk nowadays, but yeah, in Achinami. So that, and even if you manage to technically not violate the prohibition of cutting off the payas, nevertheless, if you cut it short here and you bedavka leave this long, then you are possibly in a violation of the chukos hagoyim. So there is a thing. So there's a thing called in Yiddish a chup, which is considered to be a non-Jewish hairstyle. Even this is not exactly what this is referring to. My father says when he was in high school, so apparently there was a style that, I mean, it wasn't as extreme. They used to cut here really short, cut leave here really long. They used to have just a puff of hair like in the front that would make it that would long. So they said the rabbis used to call that a chup, and they would always tell them not they have to cut it off. They can't have a chup also because there are some shittas, it's a little bit difficult, but there are some shittas that it's a problem of chatzitza with a tefillin. That if your hair is too long, then it constitutes a barrier between your head and the tefillin, which is a little strange.
You can't get much shorter than the way they...
Right, most chassidim cut their whole head very, very short, except for the payas. And we explained that when we're talking about payas, that's because that al pi kabbalah, so the hair of the head represents midas hadin, and the hair of the payas and beard represents midas harachamim. So you want to emphasize the rachamim and cut the din, the strict justice, as short as possible.
The long payas exemplify a rachamim.
Because these parts of the head, that's the kabbalistically allude to rachamim, the God's attribute of mercy. So you're trying to evoke the attribute of mercy and not the attribute of din. Okay.
The longer the pay is, the more mercy.
Yes, exactly. The nichbal zehalab mokom acher b'milos achirus. It's another place as well. Shenemar hishomer lecha pentinaki shacharehem, lest you be caught up after them. Veloshen sifri hishomer belosase pen belosase tinaki shacharehem shema tid. Also, so all these words, even though it doesn't say lo, hishomer mean be exceedingly careful, and pen mean lest. So those words indicate a negative commandment as well, even though it doesn't use the word lo or al. So if you assimilate to them and you do what they do, so they will be a trap for you. You shouldn't say, well, all the goyim are wearing purple now, so I'm going to start wearing purple. Oh, that's a new color. It doesn't mean it's us who wear purple at all. It just means that you shouldn't do it because it's the davka, the style. So something that's mounted knights or something, people that were riding a horse, so this was one of their types of garments, so you shouldn't say, oh, I'm going to wear these types of garments. I don't know exactly what it's referring to, but that's still Usher. So those should Sifri HaNevua Balka Lovshim Malbush Nachri. So the Navi Tzvanya goes off on the Jews who were wearing foreign garments. And we'll see in a second. Again, he's going to say, "Meshor shemitzvah lisrachik mem leganos koan agoseim." The idea is that we shouldn't start to like things that the non-Jews do, and then we're going to start liking the other things that are more problematic, such as avodah zarah. It's sort of like a geder d'oraisa. We don't want to start even copying them in any way. Then we're less we copy their inappropriate thoughts and actions. Afilu b'malbush. This applies even to clothing. So that's why, if you take this to the extreme, that's why certain sects feel that you need to have a specific Jewish dress. You should not go with the non-Jewish manner of dress at all. Like, see them?
Like Shtreimels.
Right, like Shtreimels.
I mean, like with just sort of normal, unremarkable, not standing out suit like you're
correct.
Wearing. Not that's not bell bottoms and it's not a ducktail haircut. If you remember those, you're not old enough.
No, I'm not old enough. But that's exactly right.
But, Even a
so Maker Hadin, if there's something that is a non-distinctive manner of dress that's just acceptable for everyone and doesn't evoke images of being not Jewish, then that is permissible. But to take it to an even more extreme, they feel the Hasidim don't necessarily feel that it's Maker Hadin. They just feel that nowadays it's or maybe there's some sort of midas chasidus to have something that's bedavka different. But I mean,
yeah. Well, nowadays I think nobody but an Orthodox Jew wear a suit and tie on a Sunday morning. So,
so this applies really only to something that's considered distinctively non-Jewish, but not something that's just considered normal. I mean, you just think throughout history, there wasn't necessarily always a distinctive Jewish manner of dress. I mean, where do you think the Hasidim got this from? This wasn't, this wasn't what Moshe Rabbeinu wore in the desert. This was something that was adopted from the Polish nobles in a few hundred years ago, and they just stuck with it. So you have to understand that the Hasidic movement was very revolutionary. Nowadays, we think of them as arch-conservatives, so basically, they were very revolutionary to begin with, and then they stayed with it. They stuck. They didn't. They stopped evolving at a certain point, which is very interesting. But
chokas agoyim, it's a peculiar kind of a word, because chok is something which has no, no purpose whatsoever. But here, it seems to be talking generally about, most importantly, about something which, in fact, does have a purpose, which is the avodah zarah.
Wait a minute. It doesn't. Not specifically things that have a purpose for avodah zarah.
Well, the question, some of the theaters and the circuses and so on and so forth, you're worried about these being connected with the avodah zarah.
For example, even in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where it talks about how to perform the death penalty of Saif, of beheading. So it's one of the... I'm not going into gory details. This is ancillary details. So it says there's a disagreement amongst the Tanaim about how to do it. And one of the Tanaim argues that you can't do it in a certain way because that's what the regular government does. The Roman government does, and you can't copy them in any way, even if their way seems to make sense. So that does nothing to do with avodah zarah. It's just they have a distinctive way of performing this death penalty.
So in fact, as far as we're concerned, it is a chok.
Exactly. So your chok business comes more into play when you have the famous tshuva of the Maharik, which is quoted by the Rama in Shulchan Aruch, which is that if there is something that's particularly goyish, but it makes sense, then it's not a problem. So, for example, I mean, this obviates a lot of the rules of chukas agoyim. So I think the example that he gives in the tshuva is that by the non-Jews, they instituted a thing that all physicians wore a certain type of coat.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And it started as clearly a non-Jewish thing. All the non-Jews were doing this. The Jewish doctors were not doing this. It became associated with a non-Jewish doctor. So the question was posed to him whether the Jewish doctors are allowed to wear this type of coat in order to indicate that they're doctors. So the Ma'arik says yes, because the Chukas HaGoyim applies to things that are just Stam Goyish Zachin, that could potentially be antithetical to Judaism or specifically associated with non-Jews for no reason, like a chok, like something that doesn't have a particular reason associated with it, as opposed to a mishpat. So therefore, it's perfectly permissible for the Jewish doctors to adopt this dress because it makes perfect sense that people should know that this person is a doctor and should seek treatment accordingly.
So you can tell that in your hospital you can tell the doctors from
right, but I mean it sounds from the shuva like they used to wear it all the time.
Yeah.
So if somebody was having an asthma attack or something on the street, so we look around quickly for a doctor and be able to figure out what was going on.
There was a certain kind of dress that the ministers wore. I think in Germany and in England, and some Orthodox rabbis, in fact, had these vestments and like that because this showed they were clergymen, right? I mean,
canonical. In the church, the rabbinate in England, they used to wear canonicals up to a certain point. Yeah,
I think
it's actually funny. There's a picture of Rabbi Hertz of Hertz Chumash fame, and there is a picture of him next to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Archbishop of Canterbury is wearing a yarmulke, and he's not. he's wearing a clerical collar even, and plain black suit.
He was Orthodox.
He was.
He was.
I'm talking about Rabbi Hertz.
He was.
Growing up in the 1950s. reform, you see, saw a vestige of it in that they would wear black, they sort of some black cassock looking thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So who doesn't like this Ma'arik, even though it's quoted by the Rama and Shulchan Aruch?
Who's Ma'arik?
His tshuva is quoted by the Rama and Shulchan Aruch, but who rips on this? The Vilna Gaon, in his commentary, Ber Hagra on the Shulchan Aruch, he says it's not true. You see from that Gemara that talks about the death penalty, that even if it does make sense to do it in a certain way, still, if it's associated with the non-Jews specifically, then the Jews are not allowed to copy this. I think Rabbi Schwartz mentioned this in his shiur on Shavuos about decorating the shul with greenery. The Vilna Gaon was not clear whether he was against all greenery or just trees. That's
trees.
You couldn't bring in trees. So that's maybe why the Vilna Gaon was opposed to this, and the Minag was the Hakel, because the Minag was the non-Jews, even if it started with the non-Jews, so they're beautifying their places of worship in honor of spring with these nice, or early summer, with these with this lovely greenery and trees. So let's do it for a shul also. It makes perfect sense, because it makes the shul look prettier. There's nothing specifically goyish about doing this. But the Vilna Gaon Lishitaso, he says it doesn't matter if it makes sense. If it's something that's specifically associated with the non-Jews, or it has originated with the non-Jews, then it would still not be permissible. And again, but this wouldn't apply to something that's just has no specific, even if Jews and non-Jews both do it, if it has no specific association with non-Jews, then, and didn't clearly start with them, then that would not be a problem. Like we said, like a manner of dress that we have nowadays would not be us or according to anyone, because of Chukas HaGoyim, is even though aspects of it, at least, are shared by Jews and non-Jews, it's just considered a general thing, in addition to the fact that, especially nowadays, it wasn't always like this, but nowadays we're even better, because you can usually tell who's Jewish and who's not Jewish just by looking at them if they're wearing more or less Western dress, either because of a yarmulke or a shetel or who knows.
Or a hat.
Right. If you look at pictures of people from the 40s, if you look at people on the streets of New York City, so everybody looks like Orthodox Jews.
Baseball game. People used to, guys used to wear hats together.
Right. So, but nowadays it's even better. But again, if there's a specific hairstyle or something that's associated specifically with non-Jews, and certainly if it contradicts Jewish principles, then you would not be allowed to do it. Oh yeah, so that's what the Ma'arik says, that it has to be something that's something specifically pre-tzedek also. That has to be something that goes against specifically Jewish values. But general stuff is okay. Midine ha-mitzvah, kasav nuktsasam, ve'yiviyu zichron al-vracham, eilu ktsasim, yeser pratea, perek shvi, mi-shabes, uve-tosefta de-shabes. The seventh perek of Masech HaShabes, and the tosefta over there will list all the darke emori types of things. There is an interesting thing that the Sefer HaChinuch does not mention, which is that if you have a Jew who is karuv l'malchus, who is close to the government, such as Jared Kushner, or in the olden days, if somebody was sitting in the court and could have the potential to have a good influence on the sovereign for the Jewish community, right? So those type of people, exactly, they were allowed to copy the non-Jewish manners of dress and hairstyle. So the question is, why? How could that be? If it's Nisr Daraisa, so why are they allowed to do it for this purpose?
Nisr Daraisa?
Yeah, Chukas HaGoyim. That's exactly what we're learning right now.
It's right here. It's Daraisa.
So why would they be allowed to do that? So the two answers are given. One is because it's for Hatzolas Klal Yisrael, since it's making sure that the Jewish people are treated well. So that's akin to Pikuach Nefesh. So then it would be allowed. Again, that wouldn't be allowed for something that's Abizrayu d'Avodah Zarah. That's something that's Ishtikal Avodah Zarah. But here, if it's not directly related to Avodah Zarah and it's just something that's associated with the non-Jewish community specifically, then it would be allowed for someone who is Karv L'Malchus. The other answer is that the Torah is extremely general over here. It doesn't give specific examples. It just says, don't do Goyish Zachen. That's the original Yiddish of the Torah. So so we have these certain things in the Torah where it's so general. So it says Misaron Akasuv LaChachamim, that the Torah gave the specific details of how the mitzvah should be carried out to the sages. So they determine essentially based on their words what the mitzvah deraisa is. So if the Chachamim say these are the exact parameters of the mitzvah, and we make a specific exemption for those who are Karv L'Malchus, who are needed by the court. So that is essentially becomes the parameters of the Isser Daraisa as well.
All plays in all times, males and females. You do
these things to make yourself similar to non-Jews. You have
lashes.
So if you would distance yourself completely from all the manners of non-Jews and you just focus on the worship of God, so you're going to dwell peacefully and you're descendants will inherit the land. So you just you have to focus on being Jewish and not try to copy too much non-Jewish things. We said also before that payas, these hairstyles of having a beard and long payas, even if it's not required mikra din, there are manners of cutting or removing those types of hairs that are acceptable at the halacha, but having specifically a beard and payas is a kiyum. You can imagine that in terms of this halacha, there are kiyumim. There are things that you can fulfill the mitzvah by, which are not necessarily absolutely required. So, in other words, just because it's not, even if it's not strictly prohibited, nevertheless, if you make yourself different actively, so it's a kiyum of this mitzvah, as opposed to violating the negative.
What a question where there's a great practical need. For example, say, using the non-Jewish calendar.
Right.
I mean, it's impossible to function really without, in fact, knowing what the secular date is. Even though for secular date, it turns out actually, in fact, you can be argued that it's not, in fact, dating back to the birth of Oso Ish. That
Yeah, but it's still Goy Shazach.
Right.
And the fact that even wherever it origins, they still say the non-Jews say B.C. and A.D. Say B.C.
Well, you don't do that when you write a check, so it's not a
right. You have a problem also with the names of the week.
Yeah.
The Ramban talks about this in the Parsha, actually, on the Paraseres HaDibros last week, Zohar is Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsha, that the Jewish method of counting the days of the week is in order to remember Shabbos all week long. So we go by numbers, first day of the week, second day of the week, so we know exactly how long it is till next Shabbos. The names that the non-Jews gave to the days, not only are they based on Avodah Zarah, but they have they're just random names.
Day.
What?
Votan's Day for Wednesday, yes.
Right.
It's just interesting, the Quakers felt the same way. They
call
Sunday is first day.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
Right, if you're in Israel, so you should absolutely. It's proper to use the Hebrew day, just like also if you celebrate birthdays in the Jewish community, different shittas about how desirable it is to celebrate birthdays, but even if you assume you should, then it's proper in the Jewish community to use the Jewish date. Absolutely.
The names of the months that we use, of course, are Babylonian, right? They're better,
Okay, so we have to make a siyum. We just finished Parshas Kedoshim. If you thought there were a lot of mitzvos in Parshas Kedoshim, you're up for even more mitzvos in Parshas Emor. And Parshas Emor, if I'm not mistaken, is its own entire volume in the Art Scroll Sefer HaChinuch.
Yes,
I think it's the only Parsha that has its own volume, which is funny. I think Kiseitze has more mitzvos, but but it does. But for some reason, Parshas Emor is the only one with its own entire volume. So we have a lot of mitzvos in here.
Have more mitzvos than any other parsha?
No, Kiseitze has the most mitzvos, but I guess they're the longest, and they require the most exposition by the Art Scroll editors. So therefore, they has its own volume here. So, Parshas Emor. Emor el HaKohanim. Yesh ba samech gimel mitzvos. They have 63 mitzvos in it. Kaf dalet mitzvos asei, velamates mitzvos lo sasei. So there are 24 mitzvos asei, and 39 mitzvos lo sasei. So here we go. Mitzvah reis samech gimel 263, which is not relevant to anyone in the room, but it's still good to know for our friends who are kohanim. Shelo yitame kohen hedyod b'meizu losi b'krovim hamavorim b'kosuv. So the prohibition that we all know that a kohen is not permitted to come into contact with a dead body in a manner that would render him a tummy, even though nowadays it doesn't really matter, tummy v'tara, because we don't have the base of Mikdash. Still, a Kohen, even nowadays, is not allowed to come into contact with a dead body in a way that would have rendered him tummy at the time. I mean, it still renders him tummy, but it just doesn't have a difference now. Zulasi bekrovim hamivorim because, but specifically, except for the family members that it enumerates specifically in the Torah. Shelo yitame Kohen hedyed b'meis. that a regular Kohen should not come into contact with a dead body. A regular Kohen Hedyot is supposed to Kohen Gadol. The Kohen should not become impure to any soul within his nation. So none of the Kohanim should become impure to a dead body. That even that a good soul, we know, is gets the afterlife, gets Olam Haba. So why does it say Lenefesh Meis? Just saying that since the nefesh is the ikar and the nefesh leaves the body, that's your main part of your existence is the soul. So that it says nefesh meis, meaning the departed soul, as opposed to that the soul is dead. Mishor sheha mitzvah. What's the reasoning? Lefisha kohanim nivcharu lavodas Hashem baruch hu. That kohanim are designated for the worship of God. Kemo shamar akasuv kedoshim yu lelokeihem. That the Kohanim shall be holy to God. Al-Kain here, Chikam in Hameis. So therefore, the Torah wants to have them keep their distance from dead bodies. So famous Chakira, whether this prohibition is an Isser Tuma or an Isser Kreva. Whether it's the prohibition is to become Tamei, per se, or whether the prohibition is to get close to the dead body. What the Nafkaminas are exactly... Airplanes, you're just sitting there in an airplane, you're not coming close to the dead body at all. So even if technically, if you fly over a cemetery and the airplane doesn't save you, according to some shitas, the airplane might save you because it's hermetically sealed from the tumah. Some soul that doesn't apply because ohel has to be something that's relatively permanent. But here, the nature of the ohel is to move, so maybe it doesn't save you. Whatever it is, it's a whole...
If there's a casket with a mace...
Oh, that's worse. Yeah,
but you don't necessarily know.
You have to ask. Kohen, there are certain flights that LL has that they never take dead bodies on it. Uh-huh. So either Kohanim take that flight, or the Kohen has to make inquiries as to whether there is any.
And they may not know until the last minute. You could have made this reservation 3 months ago.
So you can't. Yeah, or you have to go on a different airline.
So Schmitz is on a Kohen.
Yeah.
Wait. True. So other airlines don't take bodies?
No, certain
of course
ones.
They take. I'm what? Sure. Oh,
like Delta doesn't.
Is LL the only one that takes bodies?
I mean, they're probably the most used to it because most dead bodies are not transferred internationally.
That's true.
But here they're used to Jews wanting to be buried in Israel.
Going to Israel
right, yeah, so I don't know for sure they don't, but it's probably a less common, and there could be certain airlines that have a policy that they don't transport dead bodies.
But lots of
right, it's probably a big deal. I mean, it's probably actually tiresome from the point of view of an airline. Probably there are lots of regulations on both sides.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So. Maybe they would say
that. Right, so I'm sure Kohanim have done their research about which flights they're allowed to take and which flights they're not allowed to take.
But this business about flying over some is miles and miles and miles above the ground.
Right, so we have a principle that I don't think Sefer Chish mentions explicitly, so we can mention it now, which is what's called the Tuma Ritzutza. That when you have, they're very complicated principles of exactly how Tumas Mace is transferred. Mm-hmm. But one of them is that the tumah of a mace has to have something to catch it, so to speak. So if it's in a container that has a little bit of airspace on top, so the container stops the tumah. So it catches, the airspace catches the tumah, and it doesn't transfer anymore. But when you have most people, they're buried in a very small coffin, or in Israel especially, they're not buried in coffins at all. They're just buried in the shrouds and put into the ground. Then that's called tuma ritzutza, meaning a squashed tuma, that it doesn't have any airspace to catch the tuma. So the dead body is not considered caught. So the tuma of the dead body continually ascends. Bokas v'olad l'rakia.
Right.
So
how about that covers the casket?
That doesn't count because that's if there were airspace, so maybe. But the grave is filled in right down to the body. So then you have the tuma is vokas v'ola ad l'rakia, it says. So the tuma, if you have tuma ritzutza, so the tuma goes up all the way to the heavens.
But wait, so
the
tuma
transfers only if it's an open space, not if it's an enclosed space.
It has to be enclosed
in other words,
with airspace. If a mace is sitting in a building, the tuma does not go up to the rakia. Only tuma ritzutza goes up to the rakia, the squash tuma.
You're talking about a vertical, in other words, sort of a vertical transmission, as it were.
Right.
It's not like, a horizontal one.
So
because
even in a cemetery where there's not an enclosed space, the tuma
Well, you can walk on a road next to a cemetery.
Right. So we're, as we will see, so there are a few ways that Tumas Meis can be transferred. One is by touching the body. One is by carrying the body. And the other one is called Ohel, tent. Mm-hmm. So Ohel is not only if you're in the same tent, the same building as a dead body, but if you are the tent over the dead body. If you serve, or the body is a tent over you. So let's say you're walking on the road and somebody, just jumps out of a building, and maybe is dead before they touch the pavement. I don't know exactly how that would work. But the person is, you see the shadow coming over you, and you're a Kohen, and there's someone who's dead who is falling out of the building right on top of you. And that person is the OL on top of you, forms a tent over you, so the Kohen has to run out from under the path.
That's a good idea anyway,
because then the Kohen might be subject to the same problem. But or if you are an OL over the body. So, for example, there's a dead body sitting in the road, and the Kohen, and there's all the police and whatever are gathered around. The Kohen is very curious about what's going on. Ooh, what's going on? What's going on? Doesn't realize it's a dead body, and leans over to see what goes on, and forms, and the Kohen is over the dead body. So that is prohibited as well and causes tumas. The same idea as when you're in an airplane, if the airplane doesn't save you, because the airplane constitutes an enclosed space for the Kohen, but if you are over a cemetery, then you are forming a tent over the cemetery.
Now,
except, wait, by what you just said then, actually mummies should not present a problem, because they are not only... They're not squash because there's space within, but there's certainly
how much space? That's like a tefach.
There's certainly space in contemporary museums within the glass enclosed.
Oh, the glass enclosed
cases, which are airtight and which.
Well, those are not Jewish. That's the other thing.
Right, that's another thing. Right.
No, but I mean for the people who worry about it, so I don't see how they.
That's a good point, possibly. Although I remember Rav Shefter telling a story that the Reitz dinner was.
He worries about it, I think.
Yeah. The Reitz dinner was once in the Museum of Natural History.
Yeah.
So he said the question was if Kohanim could go because there are dead bodies in the museum. But the dinim are very complex.
What dead bodies?
Mummies.
Mummies, no, also pre-Columbian, I mean not pre-Columbian, prehistoric people or whatever. There are a lot of skeletons.
The Museum of American Indian, which
is skeletons
in
the closet
there,
now.
They had scalps.
Yeah.
There's a big obvious question here, which is going to be answered exhaustively around. Why on earth does this still apply now? I mean, this is a...
same reason.
Why should it be like everything else at Tumah Tahara, no more base at Mikdash, and is this some... Is this old Rabbanan?
This applies even if the Kohen's already Tummy. So, for example, even in the times of the base of Mikdash, so if the Kohen, went into a... to a dead body, for example, to deal with his parent who died, which is Mutter. So he's tummy.
Yeah.
He's tummy because of contact with a dead body. So now he's left his parents' funeral. He's walking on the way home, and he sees another funeral. He wants to participate in that funeral, so he's not allowed, even though he's already tummy. The second funeral is not going to make him more tummy. But then it's not an issue. It's not an Isser Tuma Vitara exclusively per se. It's an Isser Kreva to a dead body. Kohen is not allowed to come close to a dead body in a manner that renders him tummy, because it's a part of the Kedusha of Kohanim, which is still relevant nowadays. Yeah. That's why even nowadays a Kohen is not allowed to marry a Grusha, etc.
So wait a second. So in other words, something analogous having to do with Tumah Tahara, like a regular person, you come in contact with like a dead animal or something like that. That's not a problem.
Right.
Because there's not...
It's an animal.
No. Because in fact, because there's no Isser of coming near.
Right. Exactly.
This is a distinction, right?
Right.
It's not simply Tumah Tahara, this is the...
Right.
So what is the practical consequence of this? So
of what? Not for you, nothing.
So the Kohen blew it. So he inadvertently or vertently or whatever.
Exactly. He gets Malkus. Nowadays he doesn't get Malkus, but he would get Malkus if he went into this place where it go right on him tummy. Exactly. He has to leave right away.
When you go to a funeral, you leave the building in which the casket is being held. Once you go outside, you can wash your hands, and the tumor does not transmit. Why does it transmit?
No, it does. You're still tummy.
Yeah, so
the washing your hands doesn't help.
Yeah, it's just symbolic. Yeah.
Because in addition to the tumor, there's also spiritual impurity associated with a dead body that you want to remove from your hands. Just the same way as when you wake up in the morning, there's some sort of spiritual impurity going on, which is why you wash your hands first thing in the morning. It's more analogous to that than it is to today's technical dinam of Tumah V'Tahara.
You can't get rid of real Tumah by just washing your hands. Yeah, I mean, you have to go actually immerse yourself.
The only way of getting rid of real Tumah is, by going to the mikvah with a dead body, you need to have Hazah Shlishi V'Shvi. Right. You need to be sprinkled with the waters of the with the ashes of the Parah Aduma. So there is no way nowadays.
That happen anytime soon.
Right. Well, hopefully it will, but the there is no way of becoming tahor from Tumas Meis nowadays. It's just impossible. Right, there's nothing you can do about it. It doesn't have any practical really effect on us.
So there's no point in really washing when you wash.
No, yes. When you leave a cemetery or a funeral, you should wash, yes.
It's just like washing in the morning.
It's but you don't make a profit.
No, right.
Without a doubt, and you don't dry your hands off, either. You just...
Really?
That's a minhag. That's
well, okay, it's a minhag.
Well, usually they don't have towels there, so
right.
No, but there is dafka minhag not to dry your hands when you wash after this after a funeral. Fine. So the Kohanim are supposed to serve God. So al kein harchika min ames. So God separated them from dead bodies. So tuma is something that should be distant. One should distance oneself from, and it's a little gross. The gufa adam hameis pershu chachamim shu avi avos hatuma. So we have, when we have laws of Tumah V'Tahara, we have an Av HaTumah, which is something that could transfer Tumah to other things. And we have Rish, and what other things was called a Vlad HaTumah, a descendant of Tumah, which is Tomei, but doesn't can transfer to other things. So a dead body is called Avi Avos HaTumah, a grandfather of Tumah, because something that becomes Tomei through contact with a dead body, as opposed to other things, can transfer that Tumah to other things as well. To a second. It's really, really, really tame, more than any other thing. So when your soul, which is the exemplification of all that is good about humanity and what the levels that a human can attain, so too your soul sinned a lot when it was connected to the body. So the whole point. So now a human just went from being the pinnacle of creation to something totally worthless and not effective in the service of God at all. Now it's purely physical. There's no spirituality left in it whatsoever. So therefore, this is why it's the most severe type of tumor.
But if that's true, why are you supposed to treat the dead body with so much respect?
As an honor to what it used to be. Okay. There's a difference between honor and tumah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think the concepts are mutually exclusive at all. Because this body used to be, on the one hand, it used to be a receptacle for a soul. So that, and it's deserving of honor for that reason. But on the other hand, since it's now gone down so many notches in terms of its chashivas, its importance in terms of the scheme of things in the world, so it's subject to the very severe rules of tumah.
Also, nibel hameis. I mean, that's also just a derisa, isn't it?
Ilo salin nibel asoal hates is derived from the fact they're not allowed to keep someone hanging overnight.
Right.
Yeah.
So, for non-Kohen, though, it seemed like, you know, dead bodies are really things to be avoided by anybody. Why shouldn't it also...
Well, because the laws of Tumah V'Tahara per se are only for the regarding the Beis HaMikdash. All these things.
Yeah.
I mean, not just dead body. You should say that nowadays somebody shouldn't come into contact with, an animal that died of its own accord, which is also Tamei Tumas Nevela. But no, you're allowed to come into contact because the whole Tumah V'Tahara is batal. So even though these reasonings... Technically, you're right. Should apply even without the Beis HaMikdash. Shouldn't come close to it. That
where people aren't Kohanim, who have to go into the Beis HaMikdash occasionally.
Well, you just get tahor. The Kohen, if something happens accidentally, or he goes to his relative's funeral, then right.
Does that have anything to do with the fact that they don't bury people in caskets in Israel?
Well, that's better.
What is better?
What is better?
To bury without a casket.
Why?
Because you
the
ideas you
dead,
want.
I'm sure they wouldn't consider it.
Why? You think they care? What do you mean? Because you want to have as few barriers as possible to the decomposition of the body.
Oh, okay.
You want to become you know, go dust back to the dust, dust to dust as fast as possible.
There are regulations, in fact, in places like the United States, New York, shall we say, which says you can't bury a person outside of a casket.
Right.
So, in fact, what happens generally, the, you know, the Jewish dead with our caskets, they drill holes in the bottom or something like that. Just
really?
Like,
they drill holes?
Yeah. They drill holes so that, you know, there could be some contact with the earth or something like that.
Well, I mean, the casket will decompose soon anyway.
Well, right, because I've heard that at least, I haven't seen it. But, you
also,
know,
they have the custom of sprinkling some dirt while that's miserable.
Right, but anyway, they I've heard of this. So, again, yeah, I said I haven't seen it, but in fact, they do drill holes. So to make it, you know, have some contact with the earth and, you know.
I mean, it's not required as long as the, you know, it can decompose. You know, not allowed to bury in a sealed metal casket, which is, you know, ridiculous for anyone, really. But, yeah, you just have to, the idea is that in Israel they allow fewer barriers, which is good. V'roi be'emez, the Mishar say Hashem lisrachik b'menu. So particularly for those who serve God should be far away from this. Zulasi bikrovim shehutar lahem ki achihem besaramhu. So why the Kohanim are allowed to impurify themselves for these relatives? The chol darkei haTorah noam v'nesivo se'er shalom. We say drachei darkei noam, that the ways of the Torah are pleasantest. The Torah doesn't like to cause people ridiculously undue distress. So people are going to be so distraught when a close relative dies. So a Kohen is going to say, "What? I'm not allowed to go to my relative's funeral. I'm not allowed to even go into the place where they're being kept and, you know, cry and mourn and protect the body. You know, that's absolutely too distressing. So for that reason, they're allowed to go into those." The Reisi Remez. So the reason that I say that the tumah has to do with the separation of the soul from the body, I saw an indication of this in the Yerushalmi that says that the greatest tzaddikim are not metame. What does that mean? What does it mean that great tzaddikim are not metame?
Well, if he had that translation of the metame.
They do not convey ritual impurity.
Convey.
Well, isn't there something about the idea that, you know, the tzaddikim don't even decompose or something like that? Right.
Ufi adome ki akavan alfi shigufam tor v'noki v'lo hechti nafsham aval siel izchusa. So there you don't have such the contrast between the physicality of the body and the spirituality of the soul. So when the soul leaves the body, it's not being rent asunder. It's just the soul saying, you know, I had such a zchus that I helped this soul throughout its entire life. And we're separating more in peace, so then there's no tumah per se. That's why it's like Misa's Nishika, that when God kisses you and then dies, a very simple, very easy, pleasant death. So on these bodies, the spiritual light shall shine forever. So what exactly does this mean? The basis of this is the Yerushalmi that says that when Rebbe died, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, so it said that they announced Ein Tumah LeKohanim Hayom. There's no Kohanic status today because he's considered to be, it's sort of like a Mace Mitzvah, which we'll discuss later, is a Kohen is allowed to bury a body that has no one else to bury it. It's one of the exceptions that the Kohen is allowed to come into contact with a dead body for this. So since he was a Nasi and the leader of the whole Jewish people, so he's like a Mace Mitzvah that everybody is required to assist in the burial. So that's why it said there's no Tumah here. But doesn't mean... It doesn't literally mean that if you touch the body of the Nasi or a full tzaddik, that you would not become Tameh. You would be able to go straight from touching that into the Beis HaMikdash. It just means that the theme is like he was saying before, that it's less Tumadik because there is less of this contrast between the body and the soul. But there are certain groups that take this very seriously. And, for example, the Chassidim, who are Kohanim, go visit the Rebbe's grave because the Rebbe was a complete tzaddik, therefore he's not metame. So that is clearly not exactly what Chazal had in mind with the statement. That's not really proper. But anyway, you see that some people...
Especially if there's an ohel, right? You know, because that makes it worse.
So what do? They construct it in a way somehow that it's not a problem. That's why I think that when the Kohanim want to go visit the ohel of Lubavitcher Rebbe, so they have some manner of getting them there that doesn't involve going over any other graves, and they can stand next to it and not over it.
You're
not
supposed to go over other people's graves anyway. You're not supposed to walk over
Right, as a respectful thing, right. Sometimes you can't avoid it. Anyway, but they have some way of getting them there that wouldn't be a problem. And whatever, but there are some groups that have been known that when they visit graves of great tzaddikim, so even Kohanim go because of this principle that great tzaddikim are not metamei.
Well, women aren't